on the concrete in dime-sized droplets. His head whipped back and forth, and his eyes bulged with terror as they stared off into the mist. Other tentacles now crept and crawled over the floor inside. There were too many near the button that controlled the loading door to even think of approaching it. One of them closed around a half-liter bottle of Pepsi and carried it off. Another slipped around a cardboard carton and squeezed. The carton ruptured, and rolls of toilet paper, two packs of Delsey wrapped in cellophane, geysered upward, came down, and rolled everywhere. Tentacles seized them eagerly. One of the big ones slipped in. Its tip rose from the floor and it seemed to sniff the air. It began to advance toward Myron, and he stepped mincingly away from it, his eyes rolling madly in their sockets. A high-pitched little moan escaped his slack lips. I looked around for something, anything at all, long enough to reach over the questing tentacles and punch the shut button on the wall. I saw a janitor's pushbroom leaning against a stack-up of beer cases and grabbed it. Norm's good hand was ripped loose. He thudded down onto the concrete loading platform and scrabbled madly for a grip with his one free hand. His eyes met mine for a moment. They were hellishly bright and aware. He knew what was happening to him. Then he was pulled, bumping and rolling, into the mist. There was another scream, choked off. Norm was gone. I pushed the tip of the broom handle onto the button and the motor whined. The door began to slide back down. It touched the thickest of the tentacles first, the one that had been investigating in Myron's direction. It indented its hide, skin, whatever, and then pierced it. A black goo began to spurt from it. It writhed madly, whipping across the concrete storage area floor like an obscene bullwhip, and then it seemed to flatten out. A moment later, it was gone. The others began to withdraw. One of them had a 5-pound bag of Gaines dog food, and it wouldn't let go. The descending door cut it in two before thumping home in its grooved slot. The severed chunk of tentacle squeezed convulsively tighter, splitting the bag open and sending brown nuggets of dog food everywhere. Then it began to flop on the floor like a fish out of water, curling and uncurling, but ever more slowly, until it lay still. I prodded it with the tip of the broom. The piece of tentacle, maybe 3 feet long, closed on it savagely for a moment, then loosened and lay limp again in the confused litter of toilet paper, dog food, and bleach cartons. There was no sound, except the roar of the generator and Ollie crying inside the plywood compartment. I could see him sitting on a stool in there with his face clutched in his hands. Then I became aware of another sound, the soft, slithery sound I had heard in the dark. Only now the sound was multiplied tenfold. It was the sound of tentacles squirming over the outside of the loading door, trying to find a way in. Myron took a couple of steps toward me. "Look," he said, "you gotta understand." I looped a fist at his face. He was too surprised to even try to block it. It landed just below his nose and mashed his upper lip into his teeth. Blood flowed into his mouth. "You got him killed," I shouted. "Did you get a good look at it? Did you get a good look at what you did?" I started to pummel him, throwing wild rights and lefts, not punching the way I'd been taught in my college boxing classes, but only hitting out. He stepped back, shaking some of them off, taking others with a numbness that seemed like a kind of resignation or penance. That made me angrier. I bloodied his nose. I raised a mouse under one of his eyes that was going to black just beautifully. I clipped him a hard one on the chin. After that one, his eyes went cloudy and semi-vacant. "Look," he kept saying. "Look, look." And then I punched him low in the stomach and the air went out of him and he didn't say "look, look" anymore. I don't know how long I would have gone on punching him, but someone grabbed my arms. I jerked free and turned around. I was hoping it was Jim. I wanted to punch Jim out, too. But it wasn't Jim. It was Ollie, his round face dead pale except for the dark circles around his eyes, eyes that were still shiny from his tears. "Don't, David," he said. "Don't hit him anymore. It doesn't solve anything." Jim was standing off to one side, his face a bewildered blank. I kicked a carton of something at him. It struck one of his dingo boots and bounced away. You and your buddy are a couple of stupid assholes, I said.
Come on, David, Ollie said unhappily. Quit it.
You two assholes got that kid killed.
Jim looked down at his dingo boots. Myron sat on the floor and held his beer belly. I was breathing hard. The blood was roaring in my ears, and I was trembling all over. I sat down on a couple of cartons and put my head down between my knees and gripped my legs hard just above the ankles. I sat that way for a while with my hair in my face, waiting to see if I was going to black out or puke or what. After a bit, the feeling began to pass, and I looked up at Ollie. His pinky ring flashed subdued fire in the glow of the emergency lights.
Okay, I said dully. I'm done.
Good, Ollie said. We've got to think what to do next. The storage area was beginning to stink of exhaust again.
Shut the generator down, that's the first thing.
Yeah, let's get out of here,
Myron said. His eyes appealed to me.
I'm sorry about the kid, but you gotta understand.
I don't gotta understand anything. You and your buddy go back into the market, but you wait right there by the beer cooler, and don't say a word to anybody, not yet.
They went willingly enough, huddling together as they passed through the swinging doors. Ollie killed the generator, and just as the light started to fail, I saw a quilted rug, the sort of thing movers use to pad breakable things, flopped over a stack of returnable soda bottles. I reached up and grabbed it for Billy. There was the shuffling, blundering sound of Ollie coming out of the generator compartment. Like a great many overweight men, his breathing had a slightly heavy, wheezing sound.
David? His voice wavered a little. You still here?
Right here, Ollie. You want to watch out for all those bleach cartons.
Yeah.
I guided him with my voice, and in 30 seconds or so he reached out of the dark and gripped my shoulder. He gave a long, trembling sigh.
Christ, let's get out of here.
I could smell the Rolaids he always chewed on his breath.
This dark is bad.
It is, I said. But hang tight a minute, Ollie. I wanted to talk to you, and I didn't want those other two fuckheads listening.
Dave, they didn't twist Norm's arm. You ought to remember that.
Norm was a kid, and they weren't. But never mind, that's over. We've got to tell them, Ollie. The people in the market.
If they panic, Ollie's voice was doubtful.
Maybe they will and maybe they won't, but it will make them think twice about going out, which is what most of them want to do. Why shouldn't they? Most of them will have people they left at home. I do myself. We have to make them understand what they're risking if they go out there.
His hand was gripping my arm hard. All right, he said.
Yes. I just keep asking myself. All those tentacles. Like a squid or something. David, what were they hooked to? What were those tentacles hooked to?
I don't know, but I don't want those two telling people on their own. That would start a panic. Let's go.
I looked around, and after a moment or two located the thin line of vertical light between the swing doors. We started to shuffle toward it, wary of scattered cartons. One of Ollie's pudgy hands clamped over my forearm.
It occurred to me that all of us had lost our flashlights.
As we reached the doors, Ollie said flatly, "What we saw."
"It's impossible, David. You know that, don't you? Even if a van from the Boston Aquarium drove out back and dumped out one of those gigantic squids like in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, it would die. It would just die."
"Yes," I said. "That's right."
"So what happened?
Huh?
What happened? What is that damned mist?"
"Ollie, I don't know." We went out.
5. An argument with Norton. A discussion near the beer cooler. Verification. Jim and his good buddy Myron were just outside the doors, each with a Budweiser in his fist. I looked at Billy, saw he was still asleep, and covered him with the rug-like mover's pad. He moved a little, muttered something, and then lay still again. I looked at my watch. It was 12:15 p.m. That seemed utterly impossible. It felt as if at least 5 hours had passed since I had first gone in there to look for something to cover him with. But the whole thing, from first to last, had taken only about 35 minutes. I went back to where Ollie stood with Jim and Myron. Ollie had taken a beer, and he offered me one. I took it and gulped down half the can at once, as I had that morning cutting wood. It bucked me up a little. Jim was Jim Grandin. Myron's last name was Lafleur. That had its comic side, all right. Myron the Flower had drying blood on his lips, chin, and cheek. The eye with the mouse under it was already swelling up. The girl in the cranberry-colored sweatshirt walked by aimlessly and gave Myron a cautious look. I could have told her that Myron was only dangerous to teenage boys intent on proving their manhood, but saved my breath. After all, Ollie was right. They had only been doing what they thought was best, although in a blind, fearful way rather than in any real common interest. And now I needed them to do what I thought was best. I didn't think that would be a problem. They had both had the stuffing knocked out of them. Neither, especially Myron the Flower, was going to be good for anything for some time to come. Something that had been in their eyes when they were fixing to send Norm out to unplug the exhaust vent had gone now. Their peckers were no longer up. "We're going to have to tell these people something," I said. Jim opened his mouth to protest. "Ollie and I will leave out any part you and Myron had in sending Norm out there if you'll back up what he and I say about, well, about what got him."
"Sure," Jim said, pitifully eager. "Sure, if we don't tell, people might go out there, like that woman. That woman who..."
He wiped his hand across his mouth and then drank more beer quickly.
"Christ, what a mess!"
"David," Ollie said. "What?" He stopped, then made himself go on. "What if they get in? The tentacles?"
"How could they?" Jim asked. "You guys shut the door."
"Sure," Ollie said. "But the whole front wall of this place is plate glass." An elevator shot my stomach down about 20 floors. I had known that, but had somehow been successfully ignoring it. I looked over at where Billy lay asleep. I thought of those tentacles swarming over Norm. I thought about that happening to Billy.
"Plate glass," Myron Lafleur whispered. "Jesus Christ, in a chariot-driven sidecar."
I left the three of them standing by the cooler, each working a second can of beer, and went looking for Brent Norton. I found him in sober-sided conversation with Bud Brown at Register 2. The pair of them, Norton with his styled gray hair and his elderly stud good looks, Brown with his dour New England fizz, looked like something out of a New Yorker cartoon. As many as 2 dozen people milled restlessly in the space between the end of the checkout lanes and the long show window. A lot of them were lined up at the glass, looking out into the mist. I was again reminded of the people that congregated a building site. Mrs. Carmody was seated on the stationary conveyor belt of one of the checkout lanes, smoking a Parliament in a one-step-at-a-time filter. Her eyes measured me, found me wanting, and passed on. She looked as if she might be dreaming awake.
"Brent," I said. "David, where did you get off to?"
"That's what I'd like to talk to you about."
"There are people back at the cooler drinking beer," Brown said grimly.
He sounded like a man announcing that X-rated movies had been shown at the Deacon's party.
"I can see them in the security mirror. This has simply got to stop."
"Brent."
"Excuse me for a minute, would you, Mr. Brown?"
"Certainly."
He folded his arms across his chest and stared grimly up into the convex mirror.
"It is going to stop. I can promise you that."
Norton and I headed toward the beer cooler in the far corner of the store, walking past the housewares and notions. I glanced back over my shoulder, noticing uneasily how the wooden beams framing the tall rectangular sections of glass had buckled and twisted and splintered. And one of the windows wasn't even whole, I remembered. A pie-shaped chunk of glass had fallen out of the upper corner at the instant of that queer thump. Perhaps we could stuff it with cloth or something. Maybe a bunch of those
$3.59 ladies' tops I had noticed near the wine. My thoughts broke off abruptly, and I had to put the back of my hand over my mouth as if stifling a burp. But I was really stifling. Was the rancid flood of horrified giggles that wanted to escape me at the thought of stuffing a bunch of shirts into a hole to keep out those tentacles that had carried Norm away. I had seen one of those tentacles, a small one, squeeze a bag of dog food until it simply ruptured.
David, are you okay?
Huh?
Your face. You look like you just had a good idea or a bloody awful one.
Something hit me then. Brent, what happened to that man who came in raving about something in the mist getting John Lee Froven?
The guy with the nosebleed?
Yes, him.
He passed out, and Mr. Brown brought him around with some smelling salts from the first aid kit. Why?
Did he say anything else when he woke up?
He started in on that hallucination. Mr. Brown conducted him up to the office. He was frightening some of the women. He seemed happy enough to go. Something about the glass. When Mr. Brown said there was only one small window in the manager's office and that that one was reinforced with wire, he seemed happy enough to go. I presume he's still there.
What he was talking about is no hallucination.
No, of course it isn't.
And that thud we felt?
No, but David...
He's scared, I kept reminding myself. Don't blow up at him. You've treated yourself to one blow-up this morning, and that's enough. Don't blow up at him just because this is the way he was during that stupid property line dispute. First patronizing, then sarcastic, and finally, when it became clear he was going to lose, ugly. Don't blow up at him, because you're going to need him. He may not be able to start his own chainsaw, but he looks like the father figure of the Western world, and if he tells people not to panic, they won't. So don't blow up at him.
You see those double doors up there beyond the beer cooler?
He looked frowning.
Isn't one of those men drinking beer the other assistant manager? Weeks? If Brown sees that, I can promise you that man will be looking for a job very soon.
Brent, will you listen to me?
He glanced back at me absently. What were you saying, Dave? I'm sorry.
Not as sorry as he was going to be. Do you see those doors?
Yes, of course I do. What about them?
They give on the storage area that runs all the way along the west face of the building. Billy fell asleep, and I went back there to see if I could find something to cover him up with. I told him everything, only leaving out the argument about whether or not Norm should have gone out at all. I told him what had come in, and finally what had gone out, screaming. Brent Norton refused to believe it. No. He refused to even entertain it. I took him over to Jim, Ollie, and Myron. All three of them verified the story, although Jim and Myron the Flower were well on their way to getting drunk. Again, Norton refused to believe or even to entertain it. He simply balked.
No, he said. No, no, no. Forgive me, gentlemen, but it's completely ridiculous. Either you're having me on... He patronized us with his gleaming smile to show that he could take a joke as well as the next fellow. Or you're suffering from some form of group hypnosis.
My temper rose again, and I controlled it with difficulty. I don't think that I'm ordinarily a quick-tempered man, but these weren't ordinary circumstances. I had Billy to think about, and what was happening, or what had already happened, to Stephanie. Those things were constantly gnawing at the back of my mind.
All right, I said. Let's go back there.
There's a chunk of tentacle on the floor. The door cut it off when it came down, and you can hear them. They're rustling all over that door. It sounds like the wind in ivy.
No, he said calmly.
What? I really did believe I had misheard him. What did you say?
I said no. I'm not going back there. The joke has gone far enough.
Brent... I swear to you, it's no joke.
Of course it is, he snapped.
His eyes ran over Jim, Myron, rested briefly on Ollie Weeks, who held his glance with calm impassivity, and at last came back to me.
It's what you locals probably call a real belly buster, right, David?
Brent, look.
No, you look,
His voice began to rise toward a courtroom shout. It carried very, very well, and several of the people who were wandering around, edgy and aimless, looked over to see what was going on. Norton jabbed his finger at me as he spoke.
"It's a joke. It's a banana skin, and I'm the guy that's supposed to slip on it. None of you people are exactly crazy about out-of-towners, am I right? You all pretty much stick together, the way it happened when I hauled you into court to get what was rightfully mine. You won that one, all right. Why not? Your father was a famous artist, and it's your town. I only pay my taxes and spend my money here."
He was no longer performing, hectoring us with the trained courtroom shout. He was nearly screaming and on the verge of losing all control. Ollie Weeks turned and walked away, clutching his beer. Myron and his friend Jim were staring at Norton with frank amazement.
"Am I supposed to go back there and look at some 98-cent rubber joke novelty while these two hicks stand around and laugh their asses off?"
"Hey, you want to watch who you're calling a hick," Myron said.
"I'm glad that tree fell on your boathouse, if you want to know the truth. Glad!"
Norton was grinning savagely at me.
"Stove it in pretty well, didn't it? Fantastic. Now get out of my way."
He tried to push past me. I grabbed him by the arm and threw him against the beer cooler. A woman cawed in surprise. 2 six-packs of Bud fell over.
"You dig out your ears and listen, Brent. There are lives at stake here. My kids is not the least of them. So you listen, or I swear I'll knock the shit out of you."
"Go ahead,"
Norton said, still grinning with a kind of insane, palsied bravado. His eyes, bloodshot and wide, bulged from their sockets.
"Show everyone how big and brave you are, beating up a man with a heart condition who is old enough to be your father."
"Sock him anyway," Jim exclaimed. "Fuck his heart condition. I don't even think a cheap New York shyster like him has got a heart."
"You keep out of it," I said to Jim, and then put my face down to Norton's. I was kissing distance, if that had been what I had in mind. The cooler was off, but it was still radiating a chill.
"Stop throwing up sand. You know damn well I'm telling the truth."
"I know. No such thing," he panted.
"If it was another time and place, I'd let you get away with it. I don't care how scared you are, and I'm not keeping score. I'm scared, too. But I need you, goddammit. Does that get through? I need you."
"Let me go!"
I grabbed him by the shirt and shook him.
"Don't you understand anything? People are going to start leaving and walk right into that thing out there. For Christ's sake, don't you understand?
Let me go!"
"Not until you come back there with me and see for yourself."
"I told you no! It's all a trick, a joke.
I'm not as stupid as you take me for." "Then I'll haul you back there myself."
I grabbed him by the shoulder and the scruff of his neck. The seam of his shirt under one arm tore with a soft purring sound. I dragged him toward the double doors. Norton let out a wretched scream. A knot of people, 15 or 18, had gathered, but they kept their distance. None showed any signs of wanting to interfere.
"Help me!"
Norton cried, his eyes bulged behind his glasses. His styled hair had gone awry again, sticking up in the same 2 little tufts behind his ears. People shuffled their feet and watched.
"What are you screaming for?" I said in his ear. "It's just a joke, right? That's why I took you to town when you asked to come, and why I trusted you to cross Billy in the parking lot. Because I had this handy fog all manufactured. I rented a fog machine from Hollywood. It cost me $15,000 and another $8,000 to ship it. Also, I could play a joke on you. Stop bullshitting yourself and open your eyes."
"Let me go,"
Norton bawled. We were almost at the doors.
"Here, here, what is this? What are you doing?"
It was Brown. He bustled and elbowed his way through the crowd of watchers.
"Make him let me go,"
Norton said hoarsely.
"He's crazy."
"No, he's not crazy. I wish he were, but he isn't."
That was Ollie, and I could have blessed him. He came around the aisle behind us and stood there facing Brown. Brown's eyes dropped to the beer Ollie was holding.
"You're drinking," he said,
and his voice was surprised but not totally devoid of pleasure.
"You'll lose your job for this."
"Come on, bud," I said, letting Norton go.
"This is no ordinary situation."
"Regulations don't change," Brown said smugly. "I'll see that the company hears of it. That's my responsibility."
Norton, meanwhile, had skittered away and stood at some distance trying to straighten his shirt and smooth back his hair. His eyes darted between Brown and me nervously.
"Hey!"
Ollie cried suddenly, raising his voice and producing a bass thunder I never would have suspected from this large but soft and unassuming man.
"Hey! Everybody in the store! You want to come up back and hear this? It concerns all of you."
He looked at me levelly, ignoring Brown altogether.
"Am I doing all right?"
"Fine." People began to gather. The original knot of spectators to my argument with Norton doubled, then trebled.
"There's something you all had better know," Ollie began.
"You put that beer down right now," Brown said.
"You shut up right now," I said, and took a step toward him. Brown took a compensatory step back.
"I don't know what some of you think you are doing," he said, "but I can tell you it's going to be reported to the Federal Foods Company. All of it. And I want you to understand there may be charges."
His lips drew nervously back from his yellowed teeth, and I could feel sympathy for him. Just trying to cope. That was all he was doing. As Norton was by imposing a mental gag order on himself. Myron and Jim had tried by turning the whole thing into a macho charade. If the generator could be fixed, the mist would blow over. This was Brown's way. He was protecting the store.
"Then you go ahead and take down the names," I said. "But please don't talk."
"I'll take down plenty of names," he responded. "Yours will be head on the list, you bohemian."
"Mr. David Drayton has got something to tell you," Ollie said, "and I think you had better all listen up, in case you are planning on going home."
So I told them what had happened, pretty much as I told Norton. There was some laughter at first, then a deepening uneasiness as I finished.
"It's a lie, you know,"
Norton said. His voice tried for hard emphasis and overshadowed a stridency. This was the man I'd told first, hoping to enlist his credibility. What a balls up.
"Of course it's a lie," Brown agreed. "It's lunacy. Where do you suppose those tentacles came from, Mr. Drayton?"
"I don't know, and at this point, that's not even a very important question. They're here. There's..."
"I suspect they came out of a few of those beer cans. That's what I suspect."
This got some appreciative laughter. It was silenced by the strong, rusty hinge voice of Mrs. Carmody.
"Death!"
she cried, and those who had been laughing quickly sobered. She marched into the center of the rough circle that had formed, her canary pants seeming to give off a light of their own, her huge purse swinging against one elephantine thigh. Her black eyes glanced arrogantly around, as sharp and balefully sparkling as a magpie's. Two good-looking girls of about 16 with Camp Woodlands written on the back of their white rayon shirts shrank away from her.
"You listen, but you don't hear. You hear, but you don't believe. Which one of you wants to go outside and see for himself?"
Her eyes swept them and then fell on me.
"And just what do you propose to do about it, Mr. David Drayton? What do you think you can do about it?"
She grinned, skull-like, above her canary outfit.
"It's the end, I tell you. The end of everything. It's the last times. The moving finger has writ not in fire, but in lines of mist. The earth has opened and spewed forth its abominations."
"Can't you make her shut up?"
one of the teenage girls burst out. She was beginning to cry.
"She's scaring me."
"Are you scared, dearie?" Mrs. Carmody asked and turned on her. "You aren't scared now, no. But when the foul creatures the imp has loosed upon the face of the earth come for you..."
"That's enough now, Mrs. Carmody," Ollie said, taking her arm. "That's just fine."
"You let go of me. It's the end, I tell you. It's death. Death!"
"It's a pile of shit," a man in a fishing hat and glasses said disgustedly.
"No, sir," Myron spoke up. "I know it sounds like something out of a dope dream, but it's the flat-out truth. I saw it myself."
"I did too," Jim said.
"And me," Ollie chipped in. He had succeeded in quieting Mrs. Carmody, at least for the time being, but she stood close by, clutching her big purse and grinning her crazy grin. No one wanted to stand too close to her. They muttered among themselves, not liking the corroboration.
Several of them looked back at the big plate glass windows in an uneasy, speculative way. I was glad to see it.
Lies, Norton said. You people all lie each other up, that's all.
What you're suggesting is totally beyond belief, Brown said.
We don't have to stand here chewing it over, I told him. Come back into the storage area with me, take a look and a listen.
Customers are not allowed in the...
Bud, Ollie said, go with him. Let's settle this.
All right, Brown said. Mr. Drayton, let's get this foolishness over with.
We pushed through the double doors into the darkness. The sound was unpleasant, perhaps evil. Brown felt it too, for all his hard-headed Yankee manner. His hand clutched my arm immediately. His breath caught for a moment, and then resumed more harshly. It was a low, whispering sound from the direction of the loading door, an almost caressing sound. I swept around gently with one foot and finally struck one of the flashlights. I bent down, got it, and turned it on. Brown's face was tightly drawn, and he hadn't even seen them. He was only hearing them. But I had seen, and I could imagine them twisting and climbing over the corrugated steel surface of the door like living vines.
What do you think now? Totally beyond belief?
Brown licked his lips and looked at the littered confusion of boxes and bags. They did this. Some of it. Most of it. Come over here. He came, reluctantly. I spotted the flashlight on the shriveled and curled section of tentacle, still lying by the push broom. Brown bent toward it.
Don't touch that, I said. It may still be alive.
He straightened up quickly. I picked up the broom by the bristles and prodded the tentacle. The third or fourth poke caused it to unclench sluggishly and reveal two whole suckers and a ragged segment of a third. Then the fragment coiled again with muscular speed and lay still. Brown made a gagging, disgusted sound. Seen enough?
Yes, he said. Let's get out of here.
We followed the bobbing light back to the double doors and pushed through them. All the faces turned toward us, and the hum of conversation died. Norton's face was like old cheese. Mrs. Carmody's black eyes glinted. Ollie was drinking beer. His face was still running with trickles of perspiration, although it had gotten rather chilly in the market. The two girls with Camp Woodlands on their shirts were huddled together like young horses before a thunderstorm. Eyes. So many eyes. I could paint them, I thought with a chill. No faces, only eyes, in the gloom. I could paint them, but no one would believe they were real. Bud Brown folded his long-fingered hands primly in front of him.
People, he said, it appears we have a problem of some magnitude here.
6. Further discussion. Mrs. Carmody. Fortifications. What happened to the Flat Earth Society? The next 4 hours passed in a kind of dream. There was a long and semi-hysterical discussion following Brown's confirmation, or maybe the discussion wasn't as long as it seemed. Maybe it was just the grim necessity of people chewing over the same information, trying to see it from every possible point of view, working it the way a dog works a bone, trying to get at the marrow. It was a slow coming to belief. You could see the same thing at any New England town meeting in March. There was the Flat Earth Society, headed by Norton. They were a vocal minority of about 10 who believed none of it. Norton pointed out over and over again that there were only 4 witnesses to the bag boy being carried off by what he called the tentacles from Planet X. It was good for a laugh the first time, but it wore thin quickly. Norton, in his increasing agitation, seemed not to notice. He added that he personally did not trust one of the 4. He further pointed out that 50% of the witnesses were now hopelessly inebriated. That was unquestionably true. Jim and Myron LaFleur, with the entire beer cooler and wine rack at their disposal, were abysmally shit-faced. Considering what had happened to Norm and their part in it, I didn't blame them. They would sober off all too soon. Ollie continued to drink steadily, ignoring Brown's protests. After a while, Brown gave up, contenting himself with an occasional baleful threat about the company. He didn't seem to realize that Federal Foods, Inc., with its stores in Bridgeton, North Windham, and Portland, might not even exist anymore. For all we knew, the Eastern Seaboard might no longer exist. Ollie drank steadily, but didn't get drunk. He was sweating it out as rapidly as he could put it in. At last, as the discussion with the Flat Earthers was becoming acrimonious, Ollie spoke up.
"If you don't believe it, Mr. Norton, that's fine. I'll tell you what to do. You go on out that front door and walk around to the back. There's a great big pile of returnable beer and soda bottles there. Norm and Buddy and I put them out this morning. You bring back a couple of those bottles so we know you really went back there. You do that, and I'll personally take my shirt off and eat it."
Norton began to bluster. Ollie cut him off in that same soft, even voice.
"I tell you, you're not doing anything but damage talking the way you are. There's people here that want to go home and make sure their families are okay. My sister and her year-old daughter are at home in Naples right now. I'd like to check on them, sure. But if people start believing you and try to go home, what happened to Norm is going to happen to them."
He didn't convince Norton, but he convinced some of the leaners and fence-sitters. It wasn't what he said so much as it was his eyes. His haunted eyes. I think Norton's sanity hinged on not being convinced, or that he thought it did. But he didn't take Ollie up on his offer to bring back a sampling of returnables from Outback. None of them did. They weren't ready to go out, at least not yet. He and his little group of Flat Earthers, reduced by one or two now, went as far away from the rest of us as they could get, over by the prepared meats case. One of them kicked my sleeping son in the leg as he went past, waking him up. I went over and Billy clung to my neck. When I tried to put him down, he clung tighter and said,
"Don't do that, Daddy. Please."
I found a shopping cart and put him in the baby seat. He looked very big in there. It would have been comical except for his pale face, the dark hair brushed across his forehead just above his eyebrows, his woeful eyes. He probably hadn't been up in the baby seat of the shopping cart for as long as 2 years. These little things slide by you. You don't realize it first. And when what has changed finally comes to you, it's always a nasty shock. Meanwhile, with the Flat Earthers having withdrawn, the argument had found another lightning rod. This time it was Mrs. Carmody, and understandably enough, she stood alone. In the faded, dismal light, she was witch-like in her blazing canary pants, her bright rayon blouse, her armloads of clacking junk jewelry, copper, tortoiseshell, adamantine, and her thyroidal purse. Her parchment face was grooved with strong, vertical lines. Her frizzy gray hair was yanked flat with three horn combs and twisted in the back. Her mouth was a line of knotted rope.
"There is no defense against the will of God. This has been coming. I have seen the signs. There are those here that I have told, but there are none so blind as those who will not see."
"Well, what are you saying? What are you proposing?" Mike Hatlin broke in impatiently. He was a town selectman, although he didn't look the part now in his yachtsman's cap and saggy-seated Bermudas. He was sipping at a beer. A great many men were doing it now. Bud Brown had given up protesting, but he was indeed taking names, keeping a rough tab on everyone he could.
"Proposing?" Mrs. Carmody echoed, wheeling toward Hatlin. "Proposing? Why, I am proposing that you prepare to meet your God, Michael Hatlin." She gazed around at all of us. "Prepare to meet your God."
"Prepare to meet shit,"
Myron LaFleur said in a drunken snarl from the beer cooler.
"Old woman, I believe your tongue must be hung in the middle so it can run on both ends."
There was a rumble of agreement. Billy looked around nervously, and I slipped an arm around his shoulders.
"I'll have my say,"
she cried. Her upper lip curled back, revealing snaggle teeth that were yellow with nicotine. I thought of the dusty stuffed animals in her shop, drinking eternally at the mirror that served as their creek.
"Doubters will doubt to the end. Yet a monstrosity did drag that poor boy away. Things in the mist. every abomination out of a bad dream. Eyeless freaks. Pallid horrors. Do you doubt? Then go on out. Go on out and say howdy do.
Mrs. Carmody, you'll have to stop, I said. You're scaring my boy. The man with the little girl echoed the sentiment. She, all plump legs and scabby knees, had hidden her face against her father's stomach and put her hands over her ears. Big Bill wasn't crying, but he was close.
There's only one chance, Mrs. Carmody said.
What's that, ma'am? Mike Hatlin asked politely.
A sacrifice,
Mrs. Carmody said. She seemed to grin in the gloom.
A blood sacrifice.
Blood sacrifice. The words hung there, slowly turning. Even now, when I know better, I tell myself that then what she meant was someone's pet dog. There were a couple of them trotting around the market in spite of the regulations against them. Even now, I tell myself that. She looked like some crazed remnant of New England Puritanism in the gloom, but I suspect that something deeper and darker than mere Puritanism motivated her. Puritanism had its own dark grandfather, old Adam, with bloody hands. She opened her mouth to say something more, and a small, neat man in red pants and a natty sports shirt struck her open-handed across the face. His hair was parted with ruler evenness on the left. He wore glasses. He also wore the unmistakable look of the summer tourist.
You shut up that bad talk, he said softly and tonelessly.
Mrs. Carmody put her hand to her mouth and then held it out to us, a wordless accusation. There was blood on the palm, but her black eyes seemed to dance with mad glee.
You had it coming, a woman cried out. I would have done it myself.
They'll get hold of you, Mrs. Carmody said, showing us her bloody palm. The trickle of blood was now running down one of the wrinkles from her mouth to her chin, like a droplet of rain down a gutter.
Not today, maybe. Tonight. Tonight, when the dark comes. They'll come with the night and take someone else. With the night, they'll come. You'll hear them coming, creeping, and crawling. And when they come, you'll beg for Mother Carmody to show you what to do.
The man in the red pants raised his hand slowly.
You come on and hit me,
she whispered, and grinned her bloody grin at him. His hand wavered.
Hit me, if you dare.
His hand dropped. Mrs. Carmody walked away by herself. Then Billy did begin to cry, hiding his face against me as the little girl had done with her father.
I want to go home, he said. I want to see my mommy.
I comforted him as best I could, which probably wasn't very well. The talk finally turned into less frightening and destructive channels. The plate glass windows, the market's obvious weak point, were mentioned. Mike Hatlin asked what other entrances there were, and Ollie and Brown quickly ticked them off, two loading doors in addition to the one Norm had opened, the main in-out doors, the window in the manager's office, thick reinforced glass securely locked. Talking about these things had a paradoxical effect. It made the danger seem more real, but at the same time made us feel better. Even Billy felt it. He asked if he could go get a candy bar. I told him it would be all right so long as he didn't go near the big windows. When he was out of earshot, a man near Mike Hatlin said,
Okay, what are we going to do about those windows? The old lady may be as crazy as a bedbug, but she could be right about something moving in after dark.
Maybe the fog will blow over by then, a woman said.
Maybe, the man said, and maybe not.
Any ideas? I asked Bud and Ollie.
Hold on a sec, the man near Hatlin said. I'm Dan Miller, from Lynn, Mass. You don't know me, no reason why you should, but I got a place on Highland Lake. Bought it just this year. Got held up for it is more like it, but I had to have it.
There were a few chuckles.
Anyway, I saw a whole pile of fertilizer and lawn food bags down there. 25-pound sacks, most of them. We could put them up like sandbags, leave loopholes to look out through.
Now more people were nodding and talking excitedly. I almost said something, then held it back. Miller was right. Putting those bags up could do no harm and might do some good. But my mind went back to that tentacle squeezing the dog food bag. I thought that one of the bigger tentacles could probably do the same for a 25-pound bag of Green Acres lawn food or Vigoro, but a sermon on that wouldn't get us out or improve anyone's mood. People began to break up, talking about getting it done, and Miller yelled,
"Hold it! Hold it! Let's thrash this out while we're all together."
They came back, a loose congregation of 50 or 60 people in the corner formed by the beer cooler, the storage doors, and the left end of the meat case where Mr. McVeigh always seems to put the things no one wants, like sweetbreads and scotch eggs and sheep's brains and head cheese. Billy wove his way through them with a 5-year-old's unconscious agility in a world of giants and held up a Hershey bar. "Want this, Daddy?" "Thanks." I took it. It tasted sweet and good.
"This is probably a stupid question," Miller resumed, "but we ought to fill in the blanks. Anyone got any firearms?"
There was a pause. People looked around at each other and shrugged. An old man with grizzled white hair who introduced himself as Ambrose Cornell said he had a shotgun in the trunk of his car.
"I'll try for it, if you want,"
Ollie said. "Right now I don't think that would be a good idea, Mr. Cornell." Cornell grunted.
"Right now, neither do I, son. But I thought I ought to make the offer."
"Well, I don't really think so," Dan Miller said.
"But I thought..."
"Wait, hold it a minute," a woman said. It was the lady in the cranberry-colored sweatshirt and the dark green slacks. She had sandy blonde hair and a good figure. A very pretty young woman. She opened her purse, and from it she produced a medium-sized pistol. The crowd made an ah-ing sound, as if they had just seen a magician do a particularly fine trick. The woman who had been blushing blushed that much the harder. She rooted in her purse again and brought out a box of Smith & Wesson ammunition. "I'm Amanda Dumfries," she said to Miller. "This gun, my husband's idea. He thought I should have it for protection. I've carried it unloaded for 2 years."
"Is your husband here, ma'am?"
"No. He's in New York, on business. He's gone on business a lot. That's why he wanted me to carry the gun."
"Well," Miller said, "if you can use it, you ought to keep it. What is it, a 38?
"Yes, and I've never fired it in my life except on a target range once." Miller took the gun, fumbled around, and got the cylinder to open after a few moments. He checked to make sure it was not loaded.
"Okay," he said. "We got a gun. Who shoots good? I sure don't."
People glanced at each other. No one said anything at first. Then reluctantly, Ollie said, "I target shoot quite a lot. I have a Colt 45 and a Llama 25.
"You?" Brown said. "Huh. You'll be too drunk to see by dark."
Ollie said very clearly, "Why don't you just shut up and write down your names?"
Brown goggled at him, opened his mouth, then decided, wisely, I think, to shut it again. "It's yours," Miller said, blinking a little at the exchange.
He handed it over, and Ollie checked it again more professionally. He put the gun into his right front pants pocket and slipped the cartridge box into his breast pocket, where it made a bulge like a pack of cigarettes. Then he leaned back against the cooler, round face still trickling sweat, and cracked a fresh beer. The sensation that I was seeing a totally unsuspected Ollie Weeks persisted.
"Thank you, Mrs. Dumfries," Miller said.
"Don't mention it," she said, and I thought fleetingly that if I were her husband and proprietor of those green eyes and that full figure, I might not travel so much. Giving your wife a gun could be seen as a ludicrously symbolic act.
"This may be silly, too," Miller said, turning back to Brown with his clipboard and Ollie with his beer, "but there aren't anything like flamethrowers in the place, are there?"
"Oh, shit," Buddy Eagleton said, and then went as red as Amanda Dumfries had done.
"What is it?"
Mike Hatlin asked.
"Well, until last week we had a whole case of those little blow torches, the kind you use around your house to solder leaky pipes or mend your exhaust systems or whatever. You remember those, Mr. Brown?"
Brown nodded, looking sour.
"Sold out?" Miller asked. "No, they didn't go at all. We only sold 3 or 4 and sent the rest of the case back. What a pisser! I mean, what a shame!
Blushing so deeply he was almost purple, Buddy Eagleton retired into the background again. We had matches, of course, and salt. Someone said vaguely that he had heard salt was the thing to put on bloodsuckers and things like that. And all kinds of, cedar mops and long-handled brooms. Most of the people continued to look heartened, and Jim and Myron were too plotso to sound a dissenting note, but I met Ollie's eyes and saw a calm hopelessness in them that was worse than fear. He and I had seen the tentacles. The idea of throwing salt on them or trying to fend them off with the handles of cedar mops was funny in a ghastly way.
"Mike," Miller said, "why don't you crew this little adventure? I want to talk to Ollie and Dave here for a minute."
"Glad to," Hatlin clapped Dan Miller on the shoulder.
"Somebody had to take charge, and you did it good. Welcome to town."
"Does this mean I get a kickback on my taxes?" Miller asked. He was a banty little guy with red hair that was receding. He looked like the sort of guy you can't help liking on short notice and, just maybe, the kind of guy you can't help not liking after he's been around for a while, the kind of guy who knows how to do everything better than you do.
"No way," Hatlin said, laughing.
Hatlin walked off. Miller glanced down at my son.
"Don't worry about Billy," I said.
"Man, I've never been so worried in my whole life," Miller said.
"No," Ollie agreed and dropped an empty into the beer cooler. He got a fresh one and opened it. There was a soft hiss of escaping gas.
"I got a look at the way you two glanced at each other," Miller said.
I finished my Hershey bar and got a beer to wash it down with.
"Tell you what I think," Miller said. "We ought to get 6 people to wrap some of those mop handles with cloth and then tie them down with twine. Then I think we ought to get a couple of those cans of charcoal lighter fluid already. If we cut the tops right off the cans, we could have some torches pretty quick."
I nodded. That was good. Almost surely not good enough, not if you had seen Norm dragged out, but it was better than salt.
"That would give them something to think about, at least," Ollie said.
Miller's lips pressed together.
"That bad, huh?" he said.
"That bad," Ollie agreed, and worked his beer.
By 4:30 that afternoon, the sacks of fertilizer and lawn food were in place, and the big windows were blocked off except for narrow loopholes. A watchman had been placed at each of these, and beside each watchman was a tin of charcoal lighter fluid with the top cut off and a supply of mop-handled torches. There were 5 loopholes, and Dan Miller had arranged a rotation of sentries for each one. When 4:30 came around, I was sitting on a pile of bags at one of the loopholes, Billy at my side. We were looking out into the mist. Just beyond the window was a red bench where people sometimes waited for their rides with their groceries beside them. Beyond that was the parking lot. The mist swirled slowly, thick and heavy. There was moisture in it, but how dull it seemed, and gloomy. Just looking at it made me feel gutless and lost.
"Daddy, do you know what's happening?" Billy asked.
"No, hon," I said. He fell silent for a bit, looking at his hands, which lay limply in the lap of his tough-skinned jeans.
"Why doesn't somebody come and rescue us?" he asked finally. "The state police or the FBI or someone?"
"I don't know."
"Do you think Mom's okay?"
"Billy, I just don't know," I said, and put an arm around him.
"I want her awful bad,"
Billy said, struggling with tears.
"I'm sorry about the times I was bad to her."
"Billy," I said, and had to stop. I could taste salt in my throat. My voice wanted to tremble.
"Will it be over?"
Billy asked.
"Daddy, will it?"
"I don't know," I said, and he put his face in the hollow of my shoulder, and I held the back of his head, felt the delicate curve of his skull just under the thick growth of his hair. I found myself remembering the evening of my wedding day, watching Steph take off the simple brown dress she had changed into after the ceremony. She had had a big purple bruise on one hip from running into the side of a door the day before.
I remember looking at the bruise and thinking, when she got that, she was still Stephanie Stepanek, and feeling something like wonder. Then we had made love, and outside it was spitting snow from a dull gray December sky. Billy was crying. "Shh, Billy, shh," I said, rocking his head against me, but he went on crying. It was the sort of crying that only mothers know how to fix, right? Premature night came inside the Federal Foods. Miller and Hatlin and Bud Brown handed out flashlights, the whole stock, about 20. Norton clamored loudly for them on behalf of his group and received 2. The lights bobbed here and there in the aisles like uneasy phantoms. I held Billy against me and looked out through the loophole. The milky, translucent quality of the light out there hadn't changed much. It was putting up the bags that had made the market so dark. Several times I thought I saw something, but it was only jumpiness. One of the others raised a hesitant false alarm. Billy saw Mrs. Terman again and went to her eagerly, even though she hadn't been over to sit for him all summer. She had one of the flashlights and handed it over to him amiably enough. Soon he was trying to write his name in light on the blank glass faces of the frozen food cases. She seemed as happy to see him as he was to see her, and in a little while they came over. Hattie Terman was a tall, thin woman, with lovely red hair just beginning to streak gray. A pair of glasses hung from an ornamental chain, the sort I believe it is illegal for anyone except middle-aged women to wear, on her breast. "Is Stephanie here, David?" she asked. "No, at home," she nodded. "Alan, too. How long are you on watch here?" "Until 6. "Have you seen anything?" "No, just the mist." "I'll keep Billy until 6, if you like."
"Would you like that, Billy?"
"Yes, please," he said, swinging the flashlight above his head in slow arcs and watching it play across the ceiling. "God will keep your Steffi, and Alan too," Mrs. Terman said, and led Billy away by the hand. She spoke with serene sureness, but there was no conviction in her eyes. Around 5:30, the sounds of excited argument rose near the back of the store. Someone jeered at something someone else had said, and someone, it was Buddy Eagleton, I think, shouted, "You're crazy if you go out there!" Several of the flashlight beams pooled together at the center of the controversy, and they moved toward the front of the store. Mrs. Carmody's shrieking, derisive laugh split the gloom as abrasive as fingers drawn down a slate blackboard. Above the babble of voices came the boom of Norton's courtroom tenor.
"Let us pass, please. Let us pass."
The man at the loophole next to mine left his place to see what the shouting was about. I decided to stay where I was. Whatever the concatenation was, it was coming my way. "Please," Mike Catlin was saying, "please, let's talk this thing through."
"There's nothing to talk about," Norton proclaimed.
Now his face swam out of the gloom. It was determined and haggard and wholly wretched. He was holding one of the 2 flashlights allocated to the Flat Earthers. The corkscrewed tufts of hair still stuck up behind his ears like a cuckold's horns. He was at the head of an extremely small procession, 5 of the original 9 or 10.
"We are going out," he said.
"Don't stick to this craziness," Miller said. "Mike's right. We can talk it over, can't we? Mr. McVeigh is going to barbecue some chicken over the gas grill. We can all sit down and eat and just..." He got in Norton's way and Norton gave him a push. Miller didn't like it. His face flushed and then set in a hard expression. "Do what you want then," he said. "But you're as good as murdering these other people." With all the evenness of great resolve or unbreakable obsession, Norton said, "We'll send help back for you." One of his followers murmured agreement, but another quietly slipped away. Now there was Norton and 4 others. Maybe that wasn't so bad. Christ himself could only find 12. "Listen," Mike Hatlin said. "Mr. Norton, Brent, at least stay for the chicken. Get some hot food inside you."
"And give you a chance to go on talking? I've been in too many courtrooms to fall for that. You've psyched out 6 of my people already."
"Your people?"
Hatlin almost groaned it.
"Your people? Good Christ, what kind of talk is that? They're people, that's all. This is no game, and it's surely not a courtroom. There are, for want of a better word, there are things out there. And what's the sense of getting yourself killed?
Things, you say, Norton said, sounding superficially